From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now, and I join you from the state of California, where beginning today, you can go about life without wearing a mask, enter stores with no capacity limits, and even visit Disneyland if you're an out-of-towner. Governor Gavin Newsom calls it California's grand reopening.
We're not going to mandate. There's no mandated passports, but businesses can require verification. Businesses can require mask wearing. Businesses have the freedom of choice across the spectrum. So you're going to be in a scenario where a lot of people are going to be wearing masks.
For more, let's bring in Nicole Nixon, who covers politics and government for CAP Radio in Sacramento. Welcome, Nicole.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So the state is retiring its color-coded tier system for ranking the spread of coronavirus in each county, but it's keeping a state of emergency in place. What exactly is changing today and what isn't?
Well, like you mentioned, there are no more capacity limits at day-to-day businesses, and California's aligning now with the CDC guidance on masks, which means that fully vaccinated folks can take those off in public. However, individual businesses can still choose to require masks if they want to, and some places can require proof of vaccination to enter. They're going to be doing this for what they call mega events. So anything like a concert or a sports game with more than 5,000 people indoors can require proof of vaccination. One thing that's not changing today is that workers are still going to be required to wear masks on the job. But that could change by the end of the week. The Independent Workplace Safety Board that oversees this kind of stuff is going to vote on a new policy change on that in a couple days here. So likely to allow vaccinated workers to lose their masks, too.
So California has one of the highest rates of vaccination in the nation, about 56% of residents of all ages and about 72% of adults having had at least one dose of the vaccine. But this virus is not eradicated. Are you still hearing words of caution from public health officials? What are they saying?
Yeah, well, health officials do expect a slight uptick in cases as people get out and mix more, and they're watching all of these different variants that we're hearing about. But I am hearing that some people have been critical of how slow California has moved to lift these restrictions and align with the CDC on masks. But the infectious disease experts that I've talked to from UC San Francisco, they think it was a good idea that California waited as more people got vaccinated.
Mm. You point out in a story today that as California reopens, Governor Newsom's political future still very much depends on the state's pandemic response. He's facing this recall election. How does today's reopening fit into that?
Well, people, I think, are excited to lose their masks and sort of get back to normal. We've been, like I mentioned, kind of slow. One thing that could be trouble on the horizon for Governor Gavin Newsom is schools. And we're not sure exactly when this recall election will take place, but it could be September, October, around the time kids are going back to school. And California's been at the bottom of the list for in-person learning days this past school year. It's been a huge issue earlier in the year. And the governor expects that he says he expects all kids to be back in the classroom this fall. But if for some reason that doesn't happen, especially in larger school districts, parents could blame Newsom for that and take that out on him in the recall election around that same time.
You know, Nicole, I've been venturing out over the last few weeks, and in at least some pockets here in Southern California, it feels like people have already gone back to the way things were before the pandemic. Do you have any sense of how Californians are feeling about this step today?
Yeah, like you said, you know, it's not like we've been just staying home 24/7 the past year. You've still been able to go out and do things, especially the past 3-4 months here as case rates have improved a lot. But I think there is a desire to move on from this chapter and go back to normal, so to speak, you know, as much as we can right now. On the other hand, Californians have largely been receptive of some of these pandemic rules like mask requirements. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are businesses that decide to keep that, you know, wear a mask in the store, at least until they have sort of a better system for verifying who's been vaccinated and who hasn't. Because right now, it's the vaccine passport isn't a thing here. They're talking about an e-verify system for vaccination status because it's just an honor system with this paper card that we're hearing reports is easy to forge these cards.
a lot to watch out for, as today is the first day that California is opening where people can go about life without wearing masks and entering stores and living life as they did before the pandemic. That's Nicole Nixon of CAP Radio in Sacramento. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, President Biden meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva tomorrow, a meeting that will add to the history between the two world powers, moments like this one.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Of course, President Ronald Reagan in Berlin on June 12, 1987, speaking to a crowd, but really to the Soviet leader. The wall, of course, divided democratic West Berlin and the communist East. 2 years later, it did come down as the Soviet Union also crumbled under its own weight. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, you tweeted the strongest message that POTUS, Biden, will send to Putin won't take place at their meeting or their press conferences. Biden's clear commitment to core alliances in Europe will be the most powerful takeaway for the Russian leader. And Biden, he almost seems to be going overboard.
Well, look, the point of the international alliances after World War II was that the collective of nations was stronger than individual nations. And I think Biden feels that some of the U.S. commitment to those kinds of alliances was severed under the former president. And he's doing as much as possible personally and in terms of proclamations of policy to show that we are part of these alliances born out of World War II.
Right. Lots of backslapping, staying late at meetings, not missing a thing, as opposed to President Trump, who dissed the European allies, then was asked by a reporter while meeting with Putin in Helsinki if Putin had interfered in the 2016 election. Let's listen.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
And we should say, I mean, not that astounded people that he would believe the Russian leader more than his own agencies. But we remember in 2001, President George W. Bush said, I looked the man, Putin, in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. He's, you know, this has happened before in a way.
Yeah, I mean, they're two different issues. The moment with Bush was one where President Bush clearly underestimated what he was facing and overestimated his ability to control U.S.-Russian relations. I think the clip that you just played with President Trump disturbed many people because he was directly going against what U.S. intelligence agencies had said very strongly about interference. But both moments are about the difficulty U.S. presidents have had in dealing with Putin in the post-Soviet Union Russia.
Yeah. We heard a little of the Cold War speech from Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. Other Cold War moments include the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. America had put missiles in Italy and Turkey. In response, the Soviet Union moved them into Cuba, you know, just off the Florida coast. Here's President Kennedy on October 22nd in that year, his view of how dangerous that situation was.
Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States.
Julian, it's chilling. Some don't remember, of course, but it's hard to put in words how petrifying that moment was.
It was a frightening moment where there was a real sense that nuclear war was possible. And the more we learn about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the more we learn it was more possible than we thought. But for President Kennedy, it was very sobering. He learned about the real dangers of this Cold War conflict, and it pushed him toward a path of focusing on nuclear arms agreements and negotiation and something other than just confrontation and war. So it had a really long-lasting effect, not just on him, but in how we thought of relations with then the Soviet Union.
Yeah. I want to go way back, 1959. Then Vice President Richard Nixon went to Moscow for the grand opening of what was called the American National Exhibition and included a mock-up of an American kitchen. And they stood there in this kitchen, and Nixon spoke with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. It became known as the kitchen debate. I mean, you could see in the old-timey videos, you could see these refrigerators and things behind them. Here's Nixon.
There are some instances where you may be ahead of us. For example, in the development of the thrust of your rockets for the investigation of outer space. There may be some instances, for example, color television, where we're ahead of you.
Aha, we have color television. You know, Khrushchev laughs at that point. He says, we're going to pass you by, wave to you as you try to catch up to us. This, you know, you could watch this on TV if you had one in 1959. This was the tension between capitalism and communism.
It was, although on the other hand, it was also more concrete in that what Nixon is really boasting about are, you know, washers and dryers and television rather than grand ideological differences with communism. And it proved to be very effective, some say, even as people within the Soviet Union watched.
We'll see what comes from the Biden-Putin meeting. Julian Zelizer at Princeton University. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
On January 1st, 1863, in homes and churches throughout the country, free and enslaved Black Americans gathered. They heard something monumental was going to take place. After hundreds of years of bondage, they were going to be freed. We know this date as the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. But it would take two more years before that proclamation would become reality for those who lived in places under Confederate control, which means many of those enslaved in places like Texas did not receive word of their freedom until June 19th, 1865, also known as Juneteenth. So when did you learn about Juneteenth?
I learned about it more recently. I reconnected with Juneteenth earlier this year. But I first heard about it when I was really young, but I hadn't really re-looked into it or heard anything else about it since I was younger.
Honestly, it was always written on a calendar. So it's always been on a calendar, but I don't even think I've like fully learned about it.
That was Jean and Angie. I met them the other day in Los Angeles. And like many Americans, they never really learned about Juneteenth. There was no mention of it at schools or in textbooks. And as you heard Angie say, she only knows the date because it comes up on her calendar. Well, what does this mean for our collective understanding of slavery and how it ended? And why is that important? Clint Smith has spent the last few years thinking deeply about this question. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And Clint, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I mentioned, your new book focuses on how collective understanding of slavery is so distorted in this country. And part of that comes down to how it is taught in schools. A lot of information, a lot of important moments are ignored, including Juneteenth. What was your experience like?
Yeah, so I think generally with slavery, you know, I think I got the hits, so to speak, which is to say I learned vaguely about Harriet Tubman, about Frederick Douglass. I learned about the Underground Railroad. But even to the extent that I learned about those things, it was on a very sort of surface level and didn't explore or excavate some of the nuances of who those people were and what these systems and institutions were. And I think what happened is that it gave me a skewed sense of what slavery was. I think if you are only ever receiving the stories of a Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass, or if you're lucky, a Harriet Jacobs or a Lauda Equiano, you are receiving the stories of really exceptional individuals who found themselves in exceptional circumstances. And those stories, while deeply important, you know, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass is one of the most important books I've ever read. The stories of Harriet Tubman are deeply important to understanding what resistance could look like to this institution, but it also can distort our sense of what slavery was because the experience of those people is not necessarily reflective of the experience of the vast majority of the millions of enslaved people. And so in the context of Juneteenth, you know, I can't remember, I think it was always in the air. It was kind of a fog that swirled around me, but I don't know that it was ever explained to me. And if it was, I don't remember it well, and it wasn't done in depth. It certainly was never talked about in school, but I think I remember it being a part of something that was discussed in church. But I knew these things on a very sort of surface level and didn't understand the idiosyncrasies and nuances and the history.
Right. And learning about Juneteenth is important for understanding the history of slavery because it shows how all enslaved people weren't just suddenly freed once President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Union soldiers had to travel throughout the South to actually try to enforce it. But you know, one thing you just said that really struck me when you mentioned names like Harriet Tubman is what we were taught is that resistance itself is exceptional. Mm. Because hearing about these individual stories and you as a young boy thinking, well, how come there were just a few? Mm. By omitting those other stories, you're omitting this rich history of how resistance has always been a part of the Black experience.
The thing about enslavement is that this is a system that existed over the course of hundreds of years, over the course of generations, that impacted millions and millions and millions of people who were all individual people, who all had their own sensibilities, who all moved through the world in their own specific idiosyncratic ways, and for whom resistance could look all sorts of different ways. You know, resistance is not just running away. Resistance is not just, in the case of Frederick Douglass, getting in a fight with your slave breaker. Resistance is not just a slave rebellion. And again, we should study those things, but resistance happens in all sorts of subtle, smaller, everyday ways. When people fall in love, when people go dancing after a long day of work on a Saturday night, when little kids go and skip rocks on the creek after a long day of working in the field. Those too are acts of resistance because they are resisting the idea that they are simply chattel. And so I think that reminding ourselves and using Juneteenth as an occasion to remind ourselves that resistance was not just the massive rebellions or the dramatic acts of running away, but it was the small things. And it was people carving out aspirations and carving out community in the face of circumstances that we just couldn't imagine today.
As you heard, I spoke with folks here in the LA area and asked them when they first learned about Juneteenth. I'm really struck by a conversation I had with a mom named Erica from Pasadena. Let's listen to a little.
I am ashamed to say that it was in 2020 when most of the conversations about Juneteenth came into my everyday conversations. And I want to move forward in my life, making sure that it's a day that we acknowledge and talk about. And I have a child now, and it's so important to me that American history is talked about in a truthful manner and brings up the reality of our nation's history.
Clint, you know, Erica and I went on to have a 15-minute conversation about this topic, and you might be able to tell from her voice that she was nervous. She wanted to talk about this, but she didn't even want to give her last name because she told me she holds a lot of white guilt and shame about not knowing. And I was thinking, Erica is not alone. This really was the sentiment of so many people I chatted with. I mean, now that people know about Juneteenth and they're learning about other major historical moments like the Tulsa Massacre, what are you hoping comes from that understanding? And also getting past the emotional weight of not knowing into a more active sense of empowerment we often feel when we understand history.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people like her, as you said. There is a sense of personal accountability in which I believe it is important for people to look around and consider, not only in the context of race or in the context of slavery, but in the context of gender, in the context of sexual orientation, in the context of immigration and the history of imperialism, in the context of all of the myriad of things that affect our world, our society, our lives today. People carry a level of personal responsibility in which one should look around and consider what they don't know and attempt to learn more about the forces that have shaped what our society looks like today. At the same time, I do think that we should recognize that there has been a generations-long, often state-sanctioned effort to prevent people from learning about so much of this stuff. And it's a shame. And part of the insidiousness of white supremacy, I think, is that it takes empirical statements and turns them into ideological ones, right? So I can say the Confederacy was a treasonous army that was predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery. For many people, that would be received as an ideological statement when it in fact is just an empirical truth, when it in fact is just something that comes from primary source documents that we have in which the Confederate states said quite explicitly why they were seceding from the Union. All you have to do is look at the declarations of Confederate secession in a place like Mississippi, saying in 1861 that the reason they are seceding from the Union and ultimately would start the Civil War is because our interests are thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material good in the world. All right, so they were not vague about this, but again, part of what's happened over generations is that it is attempted to take statements like that and to make them seem controversial when they are simply based in truth.
You know, there's that saying, once you see something, you can't unsee it. How are you going into Juneteenth, thinking about your place in this country and where we're headed in this country?
I think we're in a moment where more people are beginning to recognize our proximity to this period of history. And so, you know, slavery existed for 250 years in this country, and it's only not existed for about 150. My grandfather's grandfather was someone who was born into slavery. And so when my son sits on my grandfather's lap, my four-year-old son, I think about my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded again that this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, wasn't that long ago at all. And I think when we recognize our temporal proximity to the history of slavery, then I think it gives a holiday like Juneteenth, hopefully, a different level of resonance. And at least I know it does for me. What I think most about when I think about Juneteenth is how there were millions of people across generations who were fighting to end this institution, but never got to see the end of it. And they fought for the end of slavery and knew that they might never have the opportunity to see it for themselves, but they knew that somebody someday would. And I think that that's the frame that we should, that I at least take into so many of the problems that we see in our society. It's like, well, you know, we are working to end mass incarceration. We are working to end poverty. Or we are working to end all these horrific things, not necessarily because we think we will see the end of it ourselves, but because we know that someday someone will, as long as each of us continue to do this work generation after generation after generation.
That's Clint Smith, a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
An internal investigation found that a cop with the California Highway Patrol sexually harassed 21 women. But those findings were kept secret until a new state transparency law passed. We dug through hours of tapes to find out what happens to officers who cross the line. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Stepping out has its perils. I'm vaccinated, everyone I know is, but if you go to a gathering now, what about the person you haven't seen in a while who grabs you for a hug? Thanks to one of them, who I'm sure I love dearly, I have a cold. But what about something worse, like a COVID infection that breaks through the vaccination? It's rare, but it could happen. And handshakes feel like a big step. So what's it like for politicians who shake hands all day long? In a piece that aired earlier, John Lee of member station WYPR in Baltimore takes a look.
Three, two, one.
At a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a new farmer's market, Baltimore County Executive Johnny Olszewski is pressing the flesh. I asked Olszewski how many hands he shook during his last campaign.
175,000.
That is obviously just a guesstimate, but it's not entirely unreasonable because politicians are professional handshakers. Olszewski is a huge extrovert, and in the depths of the pandemic, he says he missed that human contact. He started shaking hands again around 2 weeks ago.
Just as I was worried it would never come back, it was sort of natural to start doing it again. So, and I think it is, it's just one more sign that the end is truly in sight.
Another politician that's working the crowd at the market is Maryland State Senator Johnny Ray Salling.
Are you shaking people's hands?
Yes, I am. I sure am.
You actually just stuck your hand out to me?
I did.
But when someone presents Salling a fist bump or an elbow instead of a hand, he quickly pivots.
Some people want to give the Uno elbow. We do that. If they want to shake hands, I'll do that also.
But even now, with nearly half of Americans fully vaccinated, is handshaking a good idea? In April of last year, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, memorably said this.
I don't think we ever should ever shake hands ever again, to be honest with you.
Hands, after all, are loaded with germs that we're picking up all over the place. COVID aside, mask wearing and social distancing, as well as no handshaking, kept a lot of us from catching colds and the flu this past winter.
If you're going to bring your handshake back, just make sure you're also bringing your hand sanitizer.
That's Carrie Althoff, an associate professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She says the handshake is safer if we keep up the COVID practices of washing hands and not touching our faces. Althoff says she'll soon start shaking the hands of friends and family she knows are vaccinated.
when we're starting to talk about shaking hands in a professional setting, when you're mixing with a lot of people, you don't know their vaccination status, that type of thing. I think that's where I put forth a bit more caution for myself.
I don't know if we know the etiquette yet.
John Michael is an associate professor of management at Loyola University of Maryland's Selinger School of Business. He expects the handshake is here to stay in the business world, but what may be different is that it will be acceptable to skip the shake.
People have gotten used to not doing it for the past year. And so I think people are starting to see that, well, you know, maybe that's not the only way to greet one another.
The handshake has been with us a long time. A 9th century BC stone relief shows an Assyrian king putting it there with a Babylonian. Back at the farmer's market, Kathy Hewitt, who sells jams and jellies, is keeping up that tradition.
It's time to get back to what we were used to and stop being afraid.
At another booth, Christy Dimnowitz says she wasn't much of a handshaker to begin with.
I've always been more of like a waver or a dapper.
Perhaps those greeting options will be more common in the post-COVID new normal. For NPR News, I'm John Lee in Baltimore County, Maryland.
Verda Teta is an immigrant from Ghana. She moved here with her family to Boston's suburb of Fitchburg when she was 8. She takes nothing for granted. In high school, she excelled. She got into Harvard. She was chosen as a graduation speaker. No one was surprised at commencement last week when she was awarded a $40,000 General Excellence Scholarship. But 10 minutes later, she approached the podium again, excused herself for interrupting, and said this.
I am so very grateful for this, but I also know that I am not the one who needs this the most. And knowing my mom went to community college and how much that was helpful, I would be so very grateful if administration would consider giving the General Excellence Scholarship to someone who's going to the community college.
Okay, I'm not crying. You're crying. She gave it away. Verda Teta, you know what happened next. You got a standing ovation. How did this happen? What were you thinking those 10 minutes in your seat?
Yeah, I was really thinking primarily about my mom. When we had moved here, she knew the value of an education, which she instilled in me. But she, you know, put this to action and decided she was going to get a college degree. And the local community college was, you know, her best option. So she went to community college at the age of 39, working 2 jobs, taking care of her kids, of course, with the support of my stepfather and the family. As I was sitting down in the audience, I just kept thinking that there may be someone in this audience who is going to go through that journey. And a financial support, much like I've gotten, would alleviate so much stress. And I had that opportunity to be that change. So I did what I thought was right.
Wow. And, you know, your public high school lists 60% of kids as economically disadvantaged. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I think that it shows in a very unique way in resilient students. It shows as students who are strong because there are challenges outside of, you know, the school building, but, you know, they come to school every day and they still excel and they still continue to work hard. So there is an economic challenge, but there's also a resilience and a strength that our students have.
Well, I have to ask you, going to Harvard, are you getting a full scholarship?
I think it would be appropriate to say that, yes, Harvard was so amazing and so generous and gave me a financial aid package that, you know, covered my tuition, my room, and my board.
Well, good for you. Good for you.
Thank you.
But this award you got could have been used then for other family needs.
Yeah.
Look, we've been joking with some of my colleagues, parents who've admitted that they would have flung themselves at your ankles and held you back from going to that stage. Your mom, I understand, led the ovation.
Yes, she did. I mean, I'm so grateful to have such a supportive mom. Like you said, I didn't tell her what I was going to do before. She had no idea I was going to get the scholarship. So, I mean, she didn't even have the opportunity to do that. But I don't think that even if she knew, she would have stopped me. She's always encouraged me to help other people whenever I can, right? Regardless of where I am in life, how much I have. There's just, you know, there's always room to help other people.
Yeah. Her name is Rosemary Anand, and we have some sound from her talking about that. Let's listen.
I was just happy. I stood up and I started shouting so loud. I was afraid those in front of me would be like, why is she that loud? But I was so happy with her decision.
Again, she stood up and led your ovation.
Yeah.
What's been the conversation? You know, what have your siblings asked you? What as a family have you said about not just doing this, but the reaction it's gotten?
My whole family has supported and respected my decision with grace. And this has led to further conversation really about, you know, how can we help people more, right? I've been given a great opportunity and a great platform and a great position to help more people. And, you know, we've started a conversation about how we can do that. And, you know, this conversation kind of went beyond my family and now reaching out to different organizations as to, would you partner with me to be able to help more people? Because I've just seen so much need in my community, but also so many resilient people who are so determined and so hardworking, and an opportunity like a scholarship is really what they would need to make a great difference in the world. And I think that that's something worth investing in.
Yeah. Well, you're going to Harvard, you're going to study chemistry, tough stuff. You know, you have to focus. I'm wondering if you or your family worry at all. It's one thing to make a statement, which you did. I mean, you stood up and you just, you know, are a blazing emblem of what the child of an immigrant family in America can do, excel, be gracious in that way that you were. But do you worry about people wanting you to be a symbol? Sometimes that spotlight can get too hot. What, you're all concerned about that?
I think that I'm not too concerned about that, because I think that the want to be a beacon of hope to people kind of comes more from within than outside. And I think that it kind of goes with the question of, do you feel pressure to, you know, be great in life? No, I don't really feel much pressure from people around me, because I kind of have those high expectations within myself to be a good person, to be a role model to my siblings and my peers and my community. But I don't really feel much pressure to be a symbol. But if I do have the opportunity, it is something that I hope to use graciously and let people know that you really can do it.
Well, look out, Harvard. Here comes Verda Tedda. Verda, thank you so much. She's the high school graduate who turned down a $40,000 college scholarship and asked that it be given to someone who deserved it more than she did, someone headed to community college. Verda, by the way, do you know who that someone is?
We don't know just yet. So the scholarship was supposed to be a $10,000 scholarship a year. So this year, two students will be chosen, and they will each get $5,000. And this process will repeat for a total of 4 years that I was supposed to get the scholarship.
Wow. Look what you did. Like,
yeah,
you know, like fish and loaves, they multiplied.
Oh, I thank God so much.
That's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now we want to introduce you to a high school valedictorian who used her speech to speak about something she believes in.
Okay.
Paxton Smith graduated from Lake Highlands High School in Dallas, Texas last month, and in her speech, she took on the state's new controversial law banning abortions when a heartbeat can be detected as early as 6 weeks.
Today, I was going to talk about TV and media and content because it's something that's very important to me. However, under light of recent events, it feels wrong to talk about anything but what is currently affecting me and millions of other women in the state. Recently, the heartbeat bill was passed in Texas. Starting in September, there will be a ban on abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, regardless of whether the pregnancy was a result of rape or incest. 6 weeks. That's all women get.
Smith notes many women don't realize they are pregnant by 6 weeks. This, of course, was not the graduation speech Smith's school had pre-approved, but she went for it anyway.
We have spent our entire lives working towards our future, and without our input and without our consent, our control over that future has been stripped away from us. I am terrified that if my contraceptives fail, I am terrified that if I am raped, then my hopes and aspirations and dreams and efforts for my future will no longer matter. I hope that you can feel how gut-wrenching that is. I hope you can feel how dehumanizing it is to have the autonomy over your own body taken away from you.
Smith added, "We cannot stay silent." Her speech has since gone viral. Even Hillary Clinton has retweeted it. Smith's school said in a statement it plans to review student speech protocols ahead of next year's graduation ceremony. Smith says she plans to attend the University of Texas in Austin in the fall. Earlier this year, we took you into the world of Clubhouse. That's a social media app based entirely on real, live audio conversation, which has attracted a number of celebrities, like this conversation that Elon Musk had when he joined an interview show back in February.
Elon, what can I say? You know, thank you so much. I hope you had a fun time for your first time on Clubhouse. Did you have fun?
Yeah, it's great. This is awesome. I didn't even know it existed a week ago, so it seems cool.
Well, other companies like Facebook and Twitter and Discord are scrambling to perfect their own social audio apps to challenge Clubhouse. But could all of this hanging out in audio chat be just a passing pandemic fad? And for more on that, we're joined by NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond. Welcome, Shannon.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yeah, I'm going to just say it. This kind of feels like we're reporting on our demise.
Well, let's just think of a new opportunity for places for people
yes.
to hear you.
Let's talk about these new opportunities. I mean, this goes beyond podcasts. These are places and spaces where fans and content creators talk and perform music. I've hosted a couple of combos on Clubhouse. But there are now way more competitors out there. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, it's kind of hard to name a company right now that's not building a Clubhouse competitor. Probably the one people may be most familiar with is Twitter Spaces, which is up and running. It's Twitter's basically Clubhouse clone. But there's also one from Reddit, the messaging app Discord, which has had audio chat for a while, now has a more sort of Clubhouse style like audio room with audiences. Even LinkedIn is reportedly working on audio. And of course, the elephant in the room is Facebook, and it says it's going to launch audio rooms. So audio is absolutely like the hot format in social media right now.
You've actually spoken to some of the folks trying to make it in this world as audio-only influencers. How are they navigating these new spaces?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think a lot of these spaces are being defined very much by the people using them. So one early adopter of audio I spoke to is named Risha Howard. She's a mom of four in Indiana. She's a YouTuber. She started off using Clubhouse last year. Then she got invited by Twitter to try out Spaces when it was first testing. And that's where she really got hooked. Here's what she told me.
They said they wanted it to feel like a dinner party. They wanted you to feel like you were hosting people in your living room. Well, that's my thing. I love to have people in my living room. I love for us to sit on the couch together with a glass of wine in our hands and we just go at it for hours together, having a good time.
And, you know, along the way, she's building this following. She's gone from less than 100 followers on Twitter to more than 5,000 now. She calls herself the Queen of Spaces.
The Queen of Spaces. What have the companies themselves said about how they'd support these content creators? Can you make money the same way on these apps as you would, say, if you were a TikTok or Instagram influencer?
I mean, that's the big question, right, is like what does it take for these creators to make money? And folks at the companies, it's good for them to have high-quality content that people want to be listening to. It keeps people on the apps. Clubhouse and Facebook, they've started these funds to pay some creators to launch shows. You know, some of the companies are also doing things like letting listeners tip their favorite hosts. They're exploring ticket sales for exclusive events. And that means you don't have to be somebody with a huge following, you know, to get that brand deal. You could put out your tip jar. You could decide to put on a workshop and sell tickets. It's kind of giving people a lot more scale.
Mm. You know, when we spoke about Clubhouse earlier this year, NPR arts editor Nina Gregory described it as a third space, as this way where she could hang out in public with others during this pandemic, you know, because they can't really hang out at libraries and parks and cafes. Do you think that description really gets to why these apps are so popular right now?
I think it does. You know, these conversations, for the most part, you know, they're live. They're mostly ephemeral unless you choose to record them, and most people don't. And I think for many people, this was sort of the closest they could get in the past year to, you know, being out in public and having maybe the kind of serendipitous conversations you would have with other people. Risha Howard told me about early on when she was trying out Twitter Spaces, She sort of out of the blue sent a DM, a direct message to the rapper Soulja Boy and asked him to do a space with her. She said she wasn't even following him at the time. To her surprise, he said yes. Now they've hosted a few spaces together. And she's like, that's just not something that would have happened elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm also wondering, though, what kinds of concerns do these audio-only apps raise? I mean, it must be really challenging to moderate live audio, for example.
Yeah, that question of moderation, I mean, that's been something Clubhouse has come under a lot of scrutiny over. There have been reports of harassment, bullying, and then, of course, misinformation. That has forced Clubhouse to tighten up its rules. There are also concerns about accessibility for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And so you see companies like Twitter adding live captions to their spaces, for example. But there's probably, I think, still a long way to go to make these features truly accessible.
Well, the big question, Shannon, will any of this last? I mean, if you have the crystal ball, I think all the companies probably want to talk to you, right?
That's right. I mean, that is a big question. You know, if people can go back in person and see each other in person, how much time are they going to spend randomly chatting on their smartphones? But, you know, many of these companies I talk to, Facebook, Twitter, Discord, you know, to a large part, they're betting that habits have changed. The head of the Facebook app, Fiji Simo, told me she sees audio today as what video was a few years ago. This is just another format that people are going to be excited about using to connect. And so it makes sense to invest in it.
That's NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks, Tanya. I enjoyed it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.